We're studying from the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John. We're going to be in the 17th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. So if you would like to mark those places, we'll be prepared to turn to those in just a moment. In the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John, we read of a man named Lazarus. He was sick and he died. In 4 days, he was raised from the dead by Jesus. And those events, of course, brought a great deal of attention to Jesus that was not appreciated by the leaders of the Jews. And we find that to be somewhat of a pattern of the life of Jesus, the miracles and the teaching of Jesus. He was opposed by the leadership of the Jews. Now, dropping down toward the latter part of the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John, after Lazarus is brought forth from the dead, the text tells us, beginning in verse 47, the chief priests, therefore, and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What do we? For this man doeth many signs. If we let him alone, or thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said unto them, "Ye know nothing at all, nor do you take account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not." Now this he said, not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but that he might also gather together unto one the children of God that are scattered abroad. So from that day forth, they took counsel that they might put him to death. Now, it's not the first time they've attempted to put Jesus to death, but one of the things that, as you know, we are trying to do in our study is to put together a chronology of the life of Jesus. So we're working on a timeline. And if you'll note, if you make a note in your Bible, if not, make a mental note that as we conclude the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John and begin into the 12th chapter of the Gospel of John, we're beginning the last week of Jesus' life. Now that tells you where you are on the timeline. And it also tells you where you are in reference to the crucifixion. So these events are toward the end of Jesus' 3.5 year ministry, and we find then that he is about to be executed, the last part of the Gospel of John, almost the last half of the Gospel of John, is a discussion of the last week of Jesus' life and the events that pertain to his crucifixion. So backing up now into that we just read, we note that Caiaphas has prophesied that it's best for one man to die than for the whole nation to die. And of course, the leaders of the Jews, their great concern was that the upset that Jesus has brought among the Jews is going to cause the Romans, as the governing authority, to just pounce on them and take away their place. And that's what Caiaphas is concerned about, and the chief priests are also concerned about. And they're reacting to this miracle of the raising of Lazarus from the dead. And certainly there were other miracles that are mentioned in verse 47 that they were aware that Jesus had done. So here's the criticism. If he keeps on doing this, then we're going to lose everything. So Caiaphas, we not only want to note that he was high priest that year, and I'm not going to make a great deal of discussion on him being high priest that year. We know there was a rotation among the priests, and I think that becomes overwhelmingly evident when we read Luke chapter 1 regarding Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist. So the high priest would rotate, and we see that Caiaphas is high priest that year. And so his concern is that not only is he serving as high priest, but the text tells us that he was also a prophet. Now what he prophesied was revealed by God. And he's talking about the gathering together into one, the children of God. Of course, he's talking about that Jesus should die, not the nation. Now, this gathering together into one, we've talked about that at the conclusion of our study last week as we talked about the Jews and the Gentiles becoming one in Christ. And we discussed, as we have a number of times in times past from the Ephesian letter, chapter 2, beginning about verse 11 toward the end, following through then to the end of that chapter. So what we want to note here is that these events are escalating, and the concern is that they put Jesus to death. That's what they want. And so they're about a week away from doing that. So that puts us on the timeline. Now, this brings us to verse 54, where I want to begin our study tonight. In verse 54, it says, "Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but departed thence into the country near to the wilderness, into the city called Ephraim, and there he tarried with the disciples." Now let's pause just there. That statement that he walked no more openly, but departed and went into the wilderness area, into a city called Ephraim. Now, often when we think city, what comes to mind?
Great
big metropolitan area. No, these were not that kind of cities. And we might consider it more like a village, if you please. But be that as it may, it tells us there that he went to Ephraim, and there he tarried with the disciples. But you see, Jesus' movement now is limited. He walked no more openly among the Jews. And I'd like to underscore that expression, no more openly among the Jews. So their concern is, now we are coming upon, as you begin the 12th chapter of the Gospel of John, the observance of the Jewish feast Passover. And so they're concerned about whether or not Jesus is going to come into this Jewish city of Jerusalem to observe the feast of Passover. Will he come? And so we want to read now verses 54 through verse 57. And Randy, if you're willing and able to do that, would you read that paragraph for me, please? 54 through 57.
John 11, 54 through 57. "Therefore Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. So they were seeking for Jesus, and were saying to one another as they stood in the temple, 'What do you think, that he will not come to the feast at all?' Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he was to report it, so that they might seize him."
All right. Well, they're interested, as we noted in verse 53, they want to kill him. So you see the typical scheme of what we might call evil or corrupt political schemes to kill him. That's what they're trying to do. Anybody that sees him, you turn him in and we'll take care of it. Because we don't want our nation or our role in the nation to fold up. Now, beginning in verse 55, that's their question. The Passover is at hand. And those who went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover, they went to purify themselves. Now, that's important to us because what we note is that the observance of the Passover, as we have studied in times gone by, was a very significant feast. But what we want to note is that Jesus is coming into the city of Jerusalem. And as the custom of the Jews was to purify themselves as they came into the city. And the places to do that were, from what I've read at least, somewhat limited. So many of the Jews came into the city of Jerusalem very early so that they could engage in this process of purification. Now keep in mind that many of them have come a long way. And so what would happen to you if you had traveled, say, 20, 30, 40 miles or more to get to a particular location? And I'm not talking about getting in a fine automobile and going 75 miles an hour down an interstate highway. If you had to walk, what condition would you be in if you had traveled for many miles to get to the city of Jerusalem?
Hungry, tired, dusty.
Yeah. So this process of purification, you need to clean up. And certainly that was necessary, in fact required by the law, in order for them to participate in these Jewish feasts. So the time of the Passover of the Jews, was near. Now I want to call your attention to the audience that John is writing to. We've emphasized this, I think, a number of times, that the Gospel of John is considerably different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In what way? Anybody? Randy?
It covers a very short amount of time. The majority of it does.
All right, that's correct. So we've got chapters 1 through 11 that cover almost the entirety of Jesus' preaching.
And it only covers 7 miracles.
Yes.
And we're told why.
Yes. Yes. Now, there's another thing that we want to note about John in reference to the why. And the why of these 7 miracles. What's the purpose of John as opposed to Matthew, Mark, and Luke?
So that you might believe.
That's right. It provides evidence. The Gospel of John is what some have called apologetic. It provides evidence to Jesus' claim to be the Son of God. And that's in the passage you noted, John 20, verses 30 and 31. He tells us why he wrote, to provide such evidence. Now, there's another thing that I want to note about the Gospel of John. And I think we see it in this expression. Now, the Passover of the Jews was at hand. Primarily, who would John's audience be? I'm sorry?
Would they be Jews?
I don't think so. I think the fundamentals of John's audience would, or the primary subjects of his audience, would likely be Gentiles. And my reason for saying that is he is explaining what the Jews do. If he was writing to Jews, would such an explanation be necessary? Oh no, they would know all about that. So he's identifying the Passover of the Jews and how then that many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover, sometimes I'm told a week or maybe 2 weeks before the Passover, so that they could be sure that they had engaged in this process of purification before the Passover actually had its beginning. So this phrase, the Passover of the Jews, was near. We see it in John 2, again in John 6, and I think to identify what this is to an audience that might not be familiar with the Passover of the Jews. Having said that, it seems necessary that, as we have on the board, that John explained the customs of the Jews and the practices of the Jews. Now, in this instance, we note that if anybody was defiled in any manner by contact with a dead body or by any other ceremonial uncleanness, it was required, according to the law, and I'll not take the time to go back and study or read this, but it's on the board, Luke 22, verses 1 through 6. The law of Moses required this process in order for them to participate in this feast. So, technically, what we want to note is that uncleanness would exclude an individual from direct participation in the feast. So, this was necessary if he was to engage in that. Now, this cleansing was especially necessary, as we mentioned, for those that had traveled some distance. And we see that even concerning Paul. You remember when Paul came into the city, he wanted to get there before the Passover, and he engaged in the observance of the rites of the Jews with some that were in his company. And we read about that in Acts chapter 21. So because of the large number of people that were coming to the city of Jerusalem, now keep in mind, Jews were required to do this. So the city of Jerusalem is going to be full of devout Jews, which we see evidence of in Acts chapter 2 and beginning in the first verse. So you want to be sure that you take care of the process in time to observe these feasts. Days, the Passover and then the day of Pentecost, which followed. So having said that, we want to note then verses 56 and 57 of this context. It says in verse 56, "They sought therefore for Jesus and spoke one to another as they stood in the temple, what think ye that he will not come to the feast?" And does that sound familiar? What I'm fishing for, if you follow my train of thought here, which I know is a dangerous thing, but if you're following my train of thought, it wasn't uncommon for people to speculate on what Jesus would and what he would not do. To see if he'll heal on the Sabbath. What do you think? Think he will? Think he won't? to see if he's going to go to the city of Jerusalem and declare himself. See, his brothers, initially in the beginning of his ministry, they were questioning, if you're the Christ, then go in and declare yourself. And we know on that occasion, he did not go in a public way to make a spectacle, but he went in privately. And that's what we see even in this passage. Now, if you'll note again, what think ye? That he will not come to the feast? Do you think Jesus doesn't know what's about to happen in a week? Well, he's told his disciples that he's about to be crucified. 3 days he'd be raised from the dead. They didn't understand it then, but they did afterward. So yes, Jesus is very much aware. You'll also note in John chapter 6, I think that it is, Jesus declared that he came to do the will of his Father. And we know that as Jesus prayed in Matthew's account in the Garden of Gethsemane before he was crucified, the night before he was arrested, or the night that he was arrested, he called upon the Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. So did Jesus know what was about to happen? Absolutely. He knew exactly what was about to happen. And what we want to note here then is they're curious, the leaders of the Jews, if he'll even show up. And was there any doubt in your mind or the Lord's mind whether or not he would show up? Oh, no. No, he's going. And you'll notice in verse 57 then, now the chief priest and the Pharisees had given commandment that if any man knew where he was, that he should show it, that they might take him. So we've got a real problem here. They're interested in killing him. They've already expressed that a number of times, and they're determined to carry out this plot to execute Jesus. Now, on the one hand, notice, if you will, that it's required by law that all males should come and observe this feast. But on the other hand, if Jesus came, what's going to happen to him? So you can see the reason for the speculation whether or not he'll come. They know what their plans are, but what they don't know is what Jesus' intention was. Now, in these verses as well, notice that he had attended national festivals, if you please, in times gone by, in which the text tells us, for example, in John 2, that he taught publicly in the temple, in the temple area. You recall that occasion of casting out the money changers and so forth and so on. Now, would he continue this pattern of his ministry? Large crowds are gathering in the city, and they're looking for Jesus. Not necessarily so that they can see him perform a miracle, but much rather so they can kill him. And do you see that? Now, what we want to compare to is when he came into the city, the religious authorities had already given orders, turn him in, we'll kill him. Now, this takes us back to the account in Luke. And if we can dovetail these accounts together, I think we'll see a rather interesting chronology. Turn back with me to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17. Following the thread of the chronology in verse 11, it tells us, and it came to pass as they were on the way to Jerusalem, that he was passing along the borders of Samaria and Galilee. That's just really interesting to me for a lot of reasons. Now, maybe you can help me with this. But it tells us that he was passing along the borders of Samaria and Galilee. One source of my research, I forget now where, tells us that Luke identified broad general geographical regions where Jesus was working. He sometimes did this to focus readers on the fact that Jesus was moving deliberately toward the consummation of his mission in Jerusalem. Now, these other passages perhaps might be helpful to us, but I want to look at this map just briefly with you. Now, I sometimes say that if our chronology is correct, I think this is a correct chronology, but if it is, I want you to see where we are talking about. Here's Ephraim, where Jesus is. Now, the next map we're going to look at is up in this area where we see Samaria. But I thought he was going to Jerusalem. That's down here. How is it that you pass along the border of Samaria on your way to Jerusalem from Ephraim?
Doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make any kind of sense, does it? Well, what I want you to see is that Luke is kind of giving us a general idea. of the travels, not necessarily to indicate that he took a direct course going to Jerusalem. Now, I don't have a map that shows the defining lines, but let me just try to point it briefly across. Here's Samaria here. Here's Galilee up here. Here's Judea down here. And you'll note that Jesus is in Ephraim, and he's on his way to Jerusalem. The text doesn't tell us precisely where he is traveling, but it tells us that he's along the line somewhere here between Samaria and Judea, traveling along the line. Now, that's important to introduce this next thought, because in verse 12, it says, "And as he entered into a certain village, there met him 10 men that were lepers who stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices, saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said unto them, Go and show yourselves to the priest. And it came to pass, as they went, they were cleansed. And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, and with a loud voice, glorifying God, and he fell upon his face at his feet, giving him thanks, and he was a Samaritan." Now let's pause right there, because there's a lot of information that we want to cover in this. Keeping in mind that Jesus is passing through Samaria and Galilee, and somewhere along this border on this map, I don't know where, but Jesus passes through a village, and here are 10 lepers. Now, the thing that I want to emphasize at this point is that these lepers stood afar off. Why? You know the answer to that. Because they're lepers. Yeah. And I think of all times to establish this point, we live in a time where everybody's concerned about the virus and concerned about it being contagious and all of that kind of thing. Well, what we want to know is that God's law regarding lepers, as contagious as it was very clear and stated a long time ago. And you can read about it in Numbers chapter 15 and Leviticus chapter 13. The lepers were to be separated, and not only separated, but what else were they to do when they approached somebody that wasn't a leper? Announce that leper, unclean, you see. So the idea is to keep the lepers separated from the other people because it was indeed so contagious. Now, I understand somebody was telling me, I made this point and somebody corrected me, but I was making the point that leprosy was a very loathsome disease for which there was no cure. Now, I understand that there are some medicinal things that can be done for leprosy in today's age, like a lot of other things that treatments have been discovered. But if you were living during Bible times and you were a leper, what was going to happen to you? You're going to die. And that's just the way it is. Because leprosy was just that bad. You were going to die a very horrible, terrible, loathsome death. Now, I have on the board a picture of a man who was, or is, I guess, a leper. In some of the research that I did, I found this picture. And how would you like to look like that? Knowing that you're going to die. This is what leprosy does. It just literally rots the limb, starts here, and fingers may fall off, hand may fall off, toes, feet may just rot off. And then it just spreads and spreads until you die of leprosy. Now here's a horrible, horrible thing. Leprosy existed in ancient Bible times. As you turn in your Bible to 2 Kings, if you will, in the Old Testament, chapter 7, 2 Kings, chapter 7, you'll note there, beginning in verse 1, the text tells us, "And Elisha said, Hear ye the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, Tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, in the gate of Samaria. The captain, on whose hand the king leaned, answered the man of God and said, Behold, if Jehovah should make windows in heaven, might this thing be? And he said, Behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shall not eat thereof. Now there were 4 leprous men at the entrance of the gate, and they said one to another, Why sit we here until we die? If we say we will enter into the city, then the famine is in the city and we shall die there. And if we sit still here, we die also. What do they know is about to happen to them either way they go? If we go into the city, that the city is surrounded by the Assyrians. And so if we go into the city, we'll die of starvation. And if we stay here, we're going to die, but we'll die of leprosy. They know full well what the score is. So their idea is we'll go to the Syrians, as it were, and maybe they'll have mercy on us. They might let us live. They might kill us. But in the long and short of it, we're going to die anyhow. So we can go and have some comfort, or we can just stay here and die a leper's death. Now that's a choice, isn't it? What did they decide to do?
Go to the camp of the Syrians.
We'll go to the camp of the Syrians. And when they got there, what did they find?
Nobody.
All right, they didn't find anybody. The enemies had all fled, and they left all their sustenance, and so there's a lesson in that, too. They had to go back and tell that you don't have to remain in the city and starve to death, because over here there's food, okay? But our point is, here are lepers in Elijah's day, and what we learn is that these lepers were well aware of what leprosy does. It'll kill you. Now, nothing's changed as we come into the New Testament. As you read beginning in Luke, once again, in chapter 5, verse 12, Luke chapter 5, verse 12, there the text tells us, it came to pass while he was in one of the cities, behold, a man full of leprosy, and when he saw Jesus, fell on his face and besought him, saying, Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And he stretched forth his hand and touched him, saying, I will, be thou clean. And straightway the leprosy departed from him. And he charged him to tell no man but to go his way and show himself to the priest. Now, does that sound familiar? We're going to be reading about that in our account in Luke 17. He says, according as Moses commanded for a testimony unto them. So much the more went abroad the report concerning him. And a great multitude came together to hear, and he healed, to be healed of their infirmities. But he drew himself into the deserts and prayed. Now, this is somewhat early on in the preaching of Jesus in Luke chapter 5. Now, here we are in Luke chapter 17, and we're approaching the last week of his life. And here 10 lepers come to him, and they believe that Jesus can help them. Do you suppose that this far down into his ministry, that perhaps these lepers of Luke 17 have heard what happened to the lepers in Luke 5? So, this is terrible. Terrible disease. But it indicates to us the horror of it. So these lepers separated themselves, as you see. But their interest is, have mercy on us. And to this point, I think it's indicative of these lepers. They had some prior knowledge of what Jesus has already done. Randy?
A couple of things. One is the leper in Luke 5. There was quite a move for Jesus to touch him.
Yes.
He reached over and touched him. Immediately, the leprosy left him. And you can see that picture that we just had on the screen. If you can imagine that man, in an instant, becoming, quote-unquote, normal. Yeah, restored completely. You know, leprosy left him, meaning he was healed. He no longer had leprosy, which means he no longer looked like that.
Right.
And the same with these 10. He didn't even touch them this time. He just told them to go show yourself to the priest. As they were going, they were cleansed.
Yeah.
So it just shows you how amazing that miracle is.
Yeah. An interesting comparison, I think, that we note is in the account of Luke 5. Jesus touched the man, immediately his leprosy was gone. In this passage, Jesus simply told them, as you pointed out, he didn't touch them, but he told them to go and show yourselves to the priest. And as they went, they were cleansed. It's almost as if they didn't realize that they were cleansed until they started to do what Jesus had told them to do. And then they realized that there was something to tell. They had been cleansed. Now, interestingly enough, when you look at this man and you see what the obvious end of this is going to be, okay, and how horrible a death that's going to be, you can have a great appreciation for these 10 lepers of Luke's account to grasp at what might appear to be a straw, anything that might help this awful condition that they're in. And thus the statement, Lord, have, or Master, have mercy on us. I have on the board something that I believe from the evidence we need to take note of. And that is, it indicates that they have heard something about what Jesus is capable of doing. Something about who He is. Now, after preaching the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, you'll note that Matthew records, and I think this is an interesting analogy, Matthew records in chapter 8, beginning in verses 1 through 4, of another leper that was healed. It says, when he was come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. And behold, there came to him a leper and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And he stretched forth his hand and touched him, very parallel to Luke chapter 5 as we look. And he said, I will. And straightway the leprosy was gone. And then see that you tell no man, show yourself to the priest, just like we read in Luke chapter 5. Now, having said that, what we want to note is here are folks that come to Jesus and they have great expectations. Why would they have such expectations? Leprosy was a death sentence. And we're going to ask this man, if you will, you can take this all away. You can take this awful plague from me. Make me whole again. Would you not be pleading for mercy if you knew that there was just a glimmer of expectation that this would be taken from you? Randy?
I would say word was spreading like wildfire.
I would say so, yes. Word of his miracles. And of course, that's a concern that the leaders of the Jews have as he has raised Lazarus from the dead. Everybody's going to hear about what he can do. And when they do, our day is done. And so that's their concern. Now, if you'll turn in your New Testament to Mark's account, chapter 10, Mark chapter 10, the passage I want to read is in verse 47, but I want to begin at verse 46. Mark chapter 10, verse 46. And they came to Jericho, and as he went out from Jericho with his disciples and a great multitude, the son of Timaeus, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting by the wayside. And when he heard that it was Jesus the Nazarene, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me. And many rebuked him that he should hold his peace, but he cried out the more, a great deal, thou son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stood still and said, call ye him. And they called the blind man, saying to him, be of good cheer, arise, he calleth thee. And he, casting away his garment, sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus answered him and said, what wilt thou that I should do unto thee? And the blind man said unto him, Rabboni, that I may receive my sight. And Jesus said unto him, go thy way, thy faith hath made thee whole. And straightway he received his sight and followed him in the way. Now I want to suggest two or three things to you. And that is that Bartimaeus, he too has heard what Jesus can do. Now, he doesn't see him coming, but he hears who's coming. Jesus is coming with this great multitude. Can you imagine all the things that are being said by this multitude that Bartimaeus can hear? He knows who's coming. And so his question is, or statement is, crying out, was Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me? Now, I don't know how he lost his sight. I don't know how long he'd been blind. The Bible doesn't tell us that. But what we do learn is he has confidence that Jesus can do something about it. Based on what evidence?
What he's heard about it.
What he's heard about it. Yeah. So he believes he can do that. You see that to be true in all these illustrations. These two blind men in Matthew's account, chapter 9, verse 27. Blind men at Jericho. The woman at Cana. The father of the epileptic son in Luke or Matthew chapter 17. And then this rich man in torment cried out, of course, to Father Abraham, have mercy on me. I probably need to eliminate that from point only to establish the point that here's a man that's crying for mercy. He's not asking for Jesus to perform a miracle Go ahead.
The blind man in John 9.
John 9, yeah. He believes that Jesus can heal him. Of course, the question being asked, why was this man born blind? Jesus tells him, so that I can be glorified. I'm going to heal him. That's what he did. All right? Yeah, so we've got other illustrations of a number of miracles of people who came to Jesus who had obviously learned something about what Jesus was capable of doing with their disease or blindness or illness or whatever it was. All right, any questions or comments just here? Well, the reputation of Jesus preceded him. Would you grant that? They knew what he could do because he had established that times gone by with the performance of miracles. Now, perhaps it's noteworthy just here, maybe not so much for this class, but just so you connect this together. What a miracle is and what a miracle isn't. I think we stumble on that a whole lot, especially with folks that we're trying to talk with and help them to see that what Jesus did was indeed a miracle. A miracle is that which suspends natural law. It's not something that would take a long period of time to accomplish through medicinal means, but rather something that would occur instantly, that would suspend natural law. And that's what Jesus has done when he healed these folks. And they've heard about this, so they come to him. Randy?
I was just going to read from Luke chapter 7, beginning in verse 19. It says, summoning two of his disciples, John sent them to the Lord, saying, are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else? When the men came to him, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you to ask, are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else? At that very time, he cured many people of diseases and afflictions and evil spirits, and he gave sight to many who were blind. And he answered and said to them, go and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. Blessed is he who does not take offense at me.
Indeed. So this was manifest. What was miraculous? Present the evidence to John. If anything's convincing or compelling, it will be the evidence.
And of course, in that verse are references to the prophecies in Isaiah that's what was going to happen.
Right? So that's what we have. Have mercy on us. Now, when Jesus saw them, he said to them in verse 14, go and show yourselves to the priest. And it came to pass, as they went, they were cleansed. Now, this going and showing yourself to the priest, we talked about that from Luke chapter 5 and Matthew chapter 8. To go and show yourself to the priest, what was the purpose of that?
It was a commandment.
It was a commandment, but what was the result of it? I mean, why would they show themselves to the priest? What's he going to do?
Judge whether you were clean or not.
Yeah, judge whether you're clean or not. Yeah, so you go show yourself to the priest, and this would be the determining factor of whether or not it could be announced now that they're no longer lepers. They don't have to live in the lepers' colony.
The little rabbit hole that just went down. They talk about that leprosy isn't what we know it to be today, that a lot of times they were more of a broad thing than talking about any kind of skin disease. So because if the question comes up, well, how often do people get cured of leprosy? Why was there a law that said if you got cured, they would be able to go to a priest and get given a clean certificate, right? But because they kind of put that in a broader term, like anything that affected the skin like that,
right,
you could go afterward and, you know, heal from it. You could go to the priest, get checked out, and then get your clean bill of health. So it's just one of those things that I was like, how often did leprosy get done that they made a law for it, but it wasn't just leprosy.
Well, you're right. And that's a really interesting question to me, because Jesus commented about Naaman the leper. And he said that in the days of Naaman the leper, there were many leprosies or lepers, but only Naaman was healed. Now, does that tell you how rare a man was healed of leprosy? Many lepers in the day of Naaman, or of Naaman, but nobody was healed but Naaman, only Naaman. And that was miraculous. Now, what does that tell us then to be more specific about this particular problem? You're going to die if you got leprosy. It's not just a general skin problem. But you're right. In order to be identified as whole again, that was a determination that the priest made. All right, very good. Very, very good. All right, any questions or comments further? Randy?
I forgot where the passage is. There's where it says many of the priests believed. Does that ring a bell?
That's in John chapter 12.
Well, John 12, it has the ruler.
Oh, okay. The priest then would be in Acts 6, 7. Memory serves me. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. A great many of the priests were becoming obedient to the faith.
Well, that's what it made me think of. If, you know, these people that are being healed of diseases such as leprosy are going and talking to the priests. The priests are like, you just had leprosy. How come you don't today?
Yeah.
You know, you might have just had it yesterday.
Yeah.
You're completely healed. I just talked to Jesus and he healed me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The priests were getting evidence.
That's right.
And testimony from people that have been healed.
That's right. They were getting the evidence, and then by Acts 6, they're hearing the preaching of the apostles, who also can perform miracles.
And there's clearly in the Gospels, the many of the priests and other officials, they believed the miracles, and you can't deny them. But here we have that they were becoming obedient, which is a whole different thing. Instead of wanting to kill Jesus like so many were, now they're believing and becoming obedient to the faith.
Well, that's right. In John 6, the question was asked, when the Messiah comes, can he do anything more than what this man does? And that in response to what they've seen. And you're right, you've got indisputable evidence that a miracle has taken place. But that doesn't sway the thinking of these folks. We're still going to kill him. They don't dispute that Lazarus was dead or that he was raised from the dead. But lest everybody believe that Jesus is the Christ on the premise that he raised Lazarus from the dead, let's kill Lazarus. That just astounds me. And then you've got in the same principle being observed in Acts chapter 4. Where the lame man of Acts chapter 3 had been lame from birth, and Peter said in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, walk, and you see that in verse 6 of chapter 3. And he declared that this is how this man walks when it was called into question in verse 10 of chapter 4, that it was in the name of Jesus of Nazareth that this man stands here before you whole. And then those who were opposed to the preaching of the apostles said, what shall we do? Verse 16 of chapter 4. What shall we do to these men? For that indeed a notable miracle hath been wrought through them is manifest to all that dwell in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it. But that it spread no further, let us threaten them, and that they speak henceforth to no man in this name. Now, they not only threatened them, but we see later they tried to beat them up and keep them from doing this.
The passage that keeps coming to mind is in Mark 15:10, where it says that Pilate was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They didn't like the fact that he had power and they had not.
Right, right. Yeah, they're afraid they're going to lose theirs, lose what they have. Yeah. Pilate was a scoundrel, but we see a bit of integrity in that part of his thinking process. He knew that the reason he had been delivered up was only for envy. Yes. All right. Now, I introduced this thought a while ago. We just well to kind of kick it off, get started into it, about Naaman the leper. Now, you'll recognize, if you've heard me preach this lesson before, you'll say, I've heard that before. Well, I hope you've heard a little bit about Naaman before. But in 2 Kings chapter 5 is the text where we read about Naaman. And perhaps just a little bit of background would be helpful to us. 2 Kings chapter 5.
You have 15 seconds.
I better not start that thought then. Okay. But we'll start at 2 Kings chapter 5 next time and talk about Naaman. And we'll note that there were many lepers during that time, but only Naaman was healed. And we'll talk about some similarities, I think, between the people that saw miracles that Jesus performed and some problems that Naaman had. Okay? Comment? Question? Okay? Anyone? All right. We're through for just now. Thank you for your attention to our study and your presence as well.